Okay, let's talk then about the thing called the Mabinogion, this tradition. What is it that I'm talking about, really? Mabinogion and the Book of Taliesin, these are stories and poems that draw on quite ancient roots, but actually collected together in the early Middle Ages. One of the things that's really interesting about them is that they are recreations of things that bring together a whole lot of different influences. If you go back into Druid, if you look at the archaeology of the Celtic tribes in Druidic times, you will not find the characters in the Mabinogion. You will find echoes of them. You will not find Math, son of Mathonry, worshipped as a god, or Gwydion, son of Don. The kind of god figures we find from the ancient Druidic times are god figures like Taranis, who is the god of thunder and lightning, or Yesus, who is the god who hangs at the tree, or Teates, who is the god of the tribe. You do find reference to a figure called, Romano-British time, a figure called Maponus, who has a strong relevance to what we're talking about. But what we do find in the Mabinogion is, however, a drawing on those ancient roots and recreating them in accordance with the particular dilemmas of the time that the bards were addressing. Now, one way of thinking about this whole kind of early medieval endeavor has been called the School of Taliesin. And the suggestion being that there was a figure or group of figures who created a body of literature that reinterpreted very ancient traditions, casting them in a new form to enable them to remain accessible and still relevant within the society the people were addressing. The whole thing is a bit complicated for us, because in the 18th century, a remarkable figure called Iolo Morganwg created a wonderful but entirely spurious druidic tradition for Welsh people. To the extent of forging, there's a book called Bavadas, which some of you may or may not have come across, which is a beautiful compilation of ideas, but it's a compilation of 18th century ideas with some early traditions mingled in. But basically the problem with Bavadas is it's all made up. One of the genuine problems, infuriating edges about Iolo Morganwg, is that very likely he did have access to older sources, which we don't have now. And if he had been fighting honestly about what he had found, it would have been fascinating. But we cannot now distinguish what he made up and what he was actually drawing from older sources. The particular problem of Bavadas and the Neo-Druidic literature about that is that it's too cognitive. Bavadas is a neat system. You've got these different spheres of the world. You've got Gwynved, which is the sphere of bliss. You've got Abred, the place of changes. Anuven is sort of seen as a sort of the underworld. It's a product of the 18th century mind. Because the 18th century mind, we have to go back into that mindset, which was really about the time of the great European expansion, culturally. And the time when it was leading into the beginnings of industrialization, and the time when the mind was going to control the world. So people were very interested in systems of thought that explain things. I love Iolo, but actually a lot of his stuff is really not traditional. It's far too neat. He creates this history of the bards of Glamorgan, and it's sort of, and God, you'd love it to be true, right? Because it would be so beautiful. There were these hidden bards, and actually, It's the voice of his longing, it's his dream for a world that should have been that wasn't. And in a way, I have a lot of affection for Iolo, but a lot of the stuff you find in Bhavadas is dead ends, because it is too cognitive. It doesn't take us actually into Anuvan. Because the older literature is mysterious, is confusing, is frustrating, but it challenges us, it talks back. In a way that the formulations of Bhavadas don't. They give us something that we could believe in, they give us a structure to hold us maybe, but they don't really talk back. Because the thing that distinguishes this literature, these poems, these stories, is that if you go into them, you come into a dialogue. There's a frustrating book, the Mabinogion, and there's lots of dead ends in it, lots of peculiar jumps of plots, and it's good that it is that, because you're meant to engage with it. Where we first come across the Mabinogion in the popular culture, really, is a woman called Lady Charlotte Guest does a translation in the 19th century. Pretty much this translation. This is it's not quite the earliest, I think this is the second edition. Yeah, because it was first published in four volumes, but this is the first combined volume, published in 1895. And she translated drew from two manuscripts, the Red Book of Hergest and the White Book of Rithach. And these are, it's a fascinating thing in some ways when you sit and you think that all this stuff that I'm talking about mostly comes out of two manuscripts, only two. There are some others, older bits, fragments that you can that have been discovered since then that corroborate it. But it's that sort of extraordinary business sometimes where you think, what if somebody had lost those two things? Or, reading late at night with a candle and kind of falls over and sets fire to them. None of this would exist. It's a really interesting illustration sometimes of how life turns on the actions of one person sometimes. Maybe two people, two people in this case, because they're two collections. Because what happened is that somebody, probably, we don't know exactly, we're talking 10th, 12th, or possibly even 13th, 14th century, nobody's really sure, combined these stories into a manuscript, into two manuscripts, the Red Book and the White Book. And they call that because of the bindings. It's sort of, I remember when I first said that, it conjured up magical ideas. What's the meaning of the Red Book and the White Book? Because you've got all this, but it's odd that there is the Red Book and the White Book. Because one of the things you come across in these traditions is the interplay of colours red and white. You have it in the stories of Mavadin, you have the red dragon and the white dragon. You have the opposites of red and white, life and death, blood and bone. And so oddly, by happenstance, white dog with red ears. Exactly. These are very ancient ideas, and somehow in some mysterious way, these stories are collected in the White Book and the Red Book. But they get published in late 19th century, 1843 first of all, this edition 1895. And Lady Charlotte Guest is the first person to call them the Mabinogion. She calls the whole manuscript the Mabinogion. Welsh Mabinogi, it becomes a yon in its translation into English. And truthfully, the word Mabinogi really only applies to the something called the four branches of the Mabinogi, which in a way is one work. The four branches, which is what we're going to principally kind of look at, is one interlaced work, created, the main thinking these days, it's created by one person. It's a very intricate, interwoven piece of work. But alongside it, there are a whole host of, some of the earliest stories of Arthur. There's the Peredur, son of Avrog, which is one of the Arthurian stories, which is the earliest Grail story. There's, I'm just running with the list. There's the Lady of the Fountain, which is another Arthurian story. There's the Hanes Taliesin. There's the story of Taliesin, which is only, you'll find only included in the Lady Charlotte Guest version, because that actually is a later. You won't find that in the Red Book. That's something she bound in with it from another manuscript. And there's also a remarkable story called The Dream of Rhonabwy. Now, The Dream of Rhonabwy is—it's a joke. It's a story that says that the men of today are pygmies compared to the little men compared to the men that used to be the old great men of old. And it's one of the very early Arthurian stories, and you have this figure of Rhonabwy, who is in trouble, and running away from his enemies, and he comes to a dilapidated black house that's in a real mess. In coming into the house, he finds it's full of cow shit and urine and terrible mess. And there's a sort of angry old woman who doesn't really want to let him in, but just about lets him in and doesn't give him much to eat and really gives him a bit of a hard time, and he has a very uncomfortable bed. And he goes looking for another bed in the night, and what he finds is a musty old yellow calf skin, which he wraps himself up in. And then he has his dream. Come on to the dream in a bit, but this is a satire on the state of bardic tradition. One of the black houses are things that the ancient bards used to go into black houses into places of darkness, where they would sit, and traditionally they would sit with a stone upon their stomach, and they would go into Anuvin to receive teachings, receive stories, to compose verses. Now, this particular black house is in a really bad state. It's the other thing with the traditional Celtic houses, of course, there were animals there, but of course the houses, you know, the cattle were part of the wealth of the land and would be looked after properly. Here the cattle are not looked after. And also the fire in the house is barely burning. The fire's just gone on the verge of going out. Now, one of the great Celtic virtues as well is one of hospitality to the stranger. And the woman of the house, who in a sense represents the sort of guiding spirit behind the bardic house, who is indeed the hag, who is indeed the grach, the old hag who is like the goddess Caridwen, who is the teacher of the bards, is not welcoming and niggardly and doesn't give inspiration and is just about giving feeding. And then to top it all, one of the great things you have from the older Druidic tradition is when the Druids wanted to have great dreams, they would wrap themselves in the skin of a bull. And what poor old Rhonabwy's got to wrap himself in is a musty, moth-eaten skin of a calf. And the story goes on beyond this, so he goes into dream, and in the dream he meets a figure who was the person who caused the battle between Modred and Arthur at the end of the Arthurian epic, and who says to him that because of his troublemaking, he has had to do penance at the blue-grey stone in the far north. And he offers to be his guide into the other world, because actually, despite his unpromising beginning, Rhonabwy has in fact gone into the other world. And this figure who has completed his penance at the blue-grey stone is now able to act as an otherworldly guide, much as the Hound of Annwn was your guide, and can now show him what can be found in the other world. And he takes him to the great mustering of the hosts of Arthur. And Arthur and everybody there, they're giants, and sort of so he takes Rhonabwy to look at Arthur, and Arthur says, "Who is this little bloke? Who is this tiny fellow?" Because again, you know, the joke is there's these tiny figures coming into the underworld. We can barely see them because they become so small in themselves, because their connection to the tradition has become so slight. And this is a bardic teaching story, the Dream of Rhonabwy, because actually in the guise of a joke, he's showing us these images in distorted kind of form. Because he's showing us the sort of, if you like, the inner house of the bards, the place where the hag who holds the house, and the fire that is at the heart of the house, and the bull spirit that can wrap around us and take us into great dreams. And he talks also in the need to find a guide, and there's something about, but of course you have to do penance at the blue-grey stone of the north. We don't know what that is. We can talk about it a little while, but then if you do that, then you come into this world where there are these potent figures. Jung would have called them the archetypes, these potent figures that somehow are in the land, that are bigger than human, but which can still relate to us. And then there's a whole series of teachings in Dream of Rhonabwy about first of all, the practice of working with images. Because there's a whole, because then the guiding figure says, well, look at these people who are gathering to the host. Look at these that are coming together around the figure of Arthur. And they're figures with hosts of different colours. They're red and they're white, or they're green and black. And the top of them is coloured this, and the bottom of them is coloured that. And he says, and no one these days can remember this without the help of a book. And actually what's being instructed there is an art of practicing working with the senses and with the image, so that you can hold the different images together. And then there's a very key bit that comes together, and he's in the place, he's also enumerating the heroes. He's sort of the various heroes and champions of Arthur's court start to appear. There's various places in the Mabinogion where this happens, where the great powers of the land, the great deep archetypes are named, and you're invited to relate to them. And the principal figure he's asked to look at is the figure of Gwalchmai, and who is a Hawk of May figure. And, no, it's not Mark, it's Kai, sorry, wrong one. It's Kai, and Kai, who is this fiery kind of figure. And he comes along in a host that are, there are people that are in red and people that are in white. And around him there is a tumult. There are people from the outside are going to the inside. People from the inside are going to the outside, because such is the fire that is around Kai, that who is this kind of extraordinary sort of pillar of flame. That there is a constant circulating of energy and of opposites around him. And this whole kind of tumult is going on and on and on, and it's only stopped when the sword of Arthur is drawn, which has serpents, which has fiery serpents on either side. And there's something about the drawing of the sword which stills things. Now, this is a sort of inner discipline that's being described, which is a discipline of being at the center and allowing the fire that comes out of the pool you find in the mound, that allowing that energy to rise up and circulate, to flow. It's a sort of fiery empowered imagination, the fiery will somewhere that's at the heart of our being. And following his ability to be with that, he can then start to interact with Arthur. And Arthur starts to show him his mythical form, and he shows him the treasures of Britain. And the other thing that gets shown to him is a great game that happens between Arthur and a figure called Owain, who's the challenger of Arthur. And this is you find this a lot both in the Arthurian literature and in the Celtic literature, this idea of life as a game that is being played out between the forces of life and death. So Arthur is in this particular instance, is the preserver of life. Owain, who represents the energies of the ravens, is the energies of death. And so the indication that is being given to Rhonabwy is that by having mastered these ability ways of kind of working with image, working with the opposites, working with the discipline of the inner fire, he can now step into the deeper place where he has become in a sense big enough to be with the great archetypes of the land, to be with Arthur and Owain, and to notice the conflict of the energies of life and death. In a sense, what he's doing there, and what is being described there, in a way, is what we did just before we broke. It is this place of getting present, going into the other world, following I'm not running away from enemies, hopefully, but like Rhonabwy, what we did was to go in and down, and to cross the bridge, to cross the place into Annavan. And then we are guided somewhere. The imagery is very, very different, of course, from the image in this particular story. But what you have to do is to, without a book, be with the images, be with the things that you experience, and place yourself at the center of them, which is what Kai does. And then you have to allow that energy. Sort of, almost we've just done it once, if we're doing it over a period of time, you have to, what happens is that sense of the empowered imagination heats up the sphere around you. So this host that's around Kai is this, so what starts to happen as you work with these images, as you take them seriously, and as you remain centered in the middle of them, they start to transform. This alchemical process starts to happen. And as that starts to happen, and as you find a way of drawing the sword, which is this sword which is used a lot in the stories, as this energy of liberation that cuts you free, and that helps you to focus your energies. Now the sword then enables you to participate in an encounter with these deep archetypes that are deeply in Annavan, but always influencing the kind of the world around us. Now, that's in a way the bardic kind of mindset. Now, when you read Welsh history, you read about the bards have this numinous kind of power, where if a bard satirizes you, it can bring out boils on your skin, it can cause your death, and it can cause your destruction. Or if you are praised by a bard, it brings a great energy of life and fruitfulness into your life. Now that's because this way of understanding image and story is not entertainment. It's about connection to the deep energies of life. And the practice that we've just done is right at the heart, in a way, of understanding this whole tradition. It is first of all to become present with yourselves, present with the world around you. Not to cut off the world, but to be present in your senses so that your world travels with you as you move inwards. So it's not a dissociation, it's not a breaking away from the world. It's almost a folding of the world inward so that you come down into the mysterious place of Anuvan. We're making, when we do that, in a sense, the raid upon Anuvan. I'm just going to read you a poem that comes out of the school of Taliesin. It's called Prithai Anuvan. It means the raid of Anuvan, or the descent into the deep. Because in a way, the thing that the stories speak of are summarized in a way in this one poem. And there's a lot of relevance to the four branches, which we're going to get onto this afternoon. I'm just going to read it, first of all. Lots of different translations of it. This is a translation by my friend Kathleen Matthews, which I just like. You know, it's not the most literal, but I just like it, so I'm going to read it. I praise the sovereign, high prince of the kingly land, who encompasses the margins of the world. Gwaiv's captivity in Caerfyrddin was resonant with the tale of Poich and Pryderi. None before him was sent into it, into the heavy blue chain that bound the faithful youth. Because of the raid upon Anuvan, he solely sang. Until the world's ending, our poet's prayer shall sound. Three ship burdens of Prudwen entered within. Except seven, none rose up from Caerfyrddin. But for seven, none returned from the castle of the mound. I am renowned in fame. The song was heard in Caer Pedevran, four times revolving. My original song stems from the cauldron. By the breath of nine maidens is it kindled. The chief of Anuvin's cauldron, what is its power? Ridged with enamel, rimmed with pearl, it will not boil the coward's portion. It is not destined. The sword of Chlewach flashes before it, and in the hand of Chlewminach is it wielded. Before hell's gates lights are burning, when with Arthur we go to the harrowing. Except seven, none rose up from Caerfyrddin, but for seven, none returned from the castle of the perfect ones. I am renowned in fame, the song is heard in the foursquare fort, in the island of the flaming door. Fresh water and jet are mixed. Bright wine is the drink served to the host. Three ship burdens of Prudwen we took to sea. Except seven, none rose up from Caerregor. But for seven, none returned from the royal castle. I give no reward to the lord's bookmen, who beyond Caerwydry saw not Arthur's valour. 6,000 men there stood upon the wall. Hard it is to parley with the sentinel. Three ship burdens of Prudwen we went with Arthur. Except seven, none rose up from Caergolydd, but for seven, none returned from the castle of the wall. I give no reward to the traylift, the clerics with trailing shields, who know not who created who, nor the hour when the chick was born. Who made him? Why he went not to the meadows of Dyfwy? They know not whose the brindled ox, thick his headband, with 70 links upon his collar. When we went with Arthur on arduous visit, but for seven, none rose up from Caerfyrddin, but for seven, none returned from the high castle. I give no reward to the clerics of weak intent, who know not on what day the chief is made, who do not know the hour of the owner's birth, nor what silver-headed beast they guard. When we went with Arthur, disastrous contention, except seven, none rose up from Caer Ochrin, but for seven, none returned from the castle of the edge. Monks howl like a choir of dogs from a contest with men who know. Does the wind have one track? Is the sea one water? Is fire one fierce, invincible spark? Monks crowd together like wolves from a contest with men who know. They know not the divisions of midnight and dawn, and knowing of the wind's course. Where is the gale's force? Where does it ravage? What land does it strike? The saint's grave lies hidden deep in the ground. I praise the sovereign, the great high prince. May sadness leave me. Christ is my protector. It's a profoundly mysterious poem, but it is about the descent to Anavan. But what it's also about is the descent to find a cauldron of inspiration. That's also that the beautiful phrase that is warmed by the breath of the nine maidens. It's a beautiful image. Associated with it also is a flashing sword, a sword of light, held in the hand of Chemenach. Chemenach means the leaper. It's related to the figure of Mab Daragon, the son of prophecy, the son who will free us all. And right at the beginning of the poem, there is an image of the faithful youth. And we're told that the story is, the poem is resonant, is related to the story of Poich and Pryderi, which is the opening branch of the Mabinogion. Now, underneath all the traditions of the Mabinogion, big thing to say, isn't it? But I'm going to say it. Underneath the traditions, there is another story. There is the story of the son and the mother. Mabon, the son of Modron, means the son who is the son of the mother, who was taken from between his mother and the wall. It links with this very ancient figure of Maponus, who was a very ancient god. And we have this now, and it's an interesting, these stories written, of course, in medieval times, Christian times. And when they are speaking of the faithful youth, they're speaking of this very ancient figure, they're also speaking about Jesus and Mary. Because we're speaking of the youth who frees us all, who is himself a prisoner. And this afternoon I'm going to look in detail with you at the structure of the four branches, but the underneath of it is that there is this figure, who mysterious figure, this child who is born, who is the son of the mother. I have to remember that the Celts were a matrilineal society, so that the highest conception of divinity is female. In sort of pagan circles these days, the equality of masculinity and femininity is stressed, and that's of course right and proper. But actually, if you go back to the ancient Welsh traditions, it's not the father and the mother, it is the mother and the son. It is Mabon, the son, to Modron, the mother. And the root story of the Mabinogion is as the world's need for the energies of Mabon and Modron to be in alignment, and the continual experience of the breaking of the world and the need to heal the world, to free the prisoner to recover the cauldron, and for the sword of light to be at the service of the cauldron. So the defending, liberating sword is at the service of the cauldron warmed by the breath of the nine maidens. The poem itself is extraordinary. I'm going to spend... I have this thing in last time we go the Awen training, where we meet for 2 years. mostly studying this poem over and over, because using this poem as a jumping off point for really understanding the whole Mabinogion tradition. It is a profoundly kind of concentrated work. For example, in the beginning, I praise the sovereign, the great high prince, who encompasses the margins of the world. Now, that is a similar statement to Kai being in the middle of his host. The sovereign, the great high prince, is you. In the beginning, before you make the raid, you have to you praise and align yourself with that principle of sovereignty, of centrality. But the next thing you do, you move from the center to the margins. You encompass the margins of the world. Wonderful play on opposites all the time in this. And as you do so, you start to hear the song of the prisoner. And it's a great, you know, the lines, we'll come back to it, because it's just great, these lines. There's a wonderful form emptiness back and forth play here. The faithful youth, so it's resonant with the tale, we're already told about the captivity of Gwair. Now Gwair is this Mabon figure. He's also, come back to Gwair, his name etymologically is very similar to a Middle Welsh word called Caiwair, which means most excellent. So Gwair in a certain way his name can also mean hay, making hay, gathering in the hay. So he is the most excellent son who comes out of the ground, who is the hay that is gathered into that is needed. It's a common word, hay, but it is gathered in to form the nourishment that keeps you through the winter. And his captivity, we are told, is resonant with the tale of Poilc and Pryderi, and therefore resonant with the whole four branches of the Mabinogi, which is the beginning, because this is the beginning tale that's interlaced with the whole thing. None before him was sent into the captivity of Anuvin, is what the poem then says. So this is the primal prisoner. This is the prisoner before the beginnings of the world. And all other imprisonments in ourselves and in the world are reflections of that imprisonment. Because he is the first prisoner. Now he sings. He sings because of the raid upon Anuvin. And yet the raid upon Anuvin is made to free the prisoner. It's a wonderful back and forth image. He sings because of the raid, and his song in a certain sense guides us into the depths. But he only sings because of the raid of Anuvin. How can that be? So it immediately we're taken into this in, out, what does this mean? Oh God. And then what we're told, until the world's ending, our poet's prayer shall sound. So this prayer, which is the prayer coming out of the depths, is also the prayer. So it's the prayer of Gwair or of Pryderi, the prayer of Mabon, but it's also the prayer of Taliesin, who is the poet here. So again, we've got the prayer coming in both directions. And then we have the three ship burdens of Prudwin. Prudwin is the white ship. It's the ship of Arthur. It's the vessel through which we enter the other world. And the first place we enter is Caerfyrddin, the castle of the mound. So it's the mound that we enter. We entered into Caerfyrddin. But only seven return. Three ship burdens. So it's a journey of a complicated journey of entering into imprisonment and thereby finding freedom, of entering into loss and thereby gaining. And in a way that this whole poem really takes us through the various stages of the journey into Anuvin. So we have these various places that are encountered, and there's the commentaries among, I could do commentaries, we can all do commentaries on this poem, there's millions of them, but actually if we take them very, very simply for a moment, just for now, what happens next? I'm renowned in fame, the song is heard in Caer Pedevran, four times revolving. Now Pedevran means the four square castle, so it's very fixed, but it's a turning castle. And one of the things that happens to you when you make the descent, when you go down into the inner place, you encounter the fixed and the moving. This is a version of Kai of Padevran. It's this confusion between, actually it feels quite solid and then it shifts, and then there's the whole, well, is it real? Is it fixed or is it solid? Is it a real thing? Have I just imagined it? All this are part of the experience of Kai of Padevran. And as we penetrate in a way that mystery of the fixed and the form, we're then given this the idea that the original song, the song of the prisoner, stems out of the cauldron. So somewhere is connected with this mysterious cauldron that is owned by Pen Anuvin, by the one who has mastered the experience of Anuvin, who is, Pen means chieftain, but it can also mean origin. So it's the one who has come to the origin of Anuvin, who is the possessor and holder of this cauldron warmed by the breath of the nine maidens, that will not boil the food of a coward. So it sort of says that, you know, so that it's soft, very beautiful, but actually it's the hero's cauldron. You have to be quite brave, heroic, in order for your food to be boiled properly. And then the next image we're given immediately is the sword of Chloac, that is handed, and this is this energy of that cuts through, this energy of insight that we possess, that's held in the hand of the leaper, the part of ourselves that can make the leap of insight, that can be like the Mab Daragon, who can be the figure who jumps over obstacles. There's a lot of, in the Mabinogion, there are people, there's a figure in Cuilhac and Olwen, for example, called Gorai, the best boy there ever was in the world, who kills a great giant figure by leaping over three courtyards and cutting off his head in one bound. There's all kinds of meanings in that, but one of the meanings is that part of ourselves that can make the leap of insight, that can go to the heart of the matter, that can kill the monster at the heart of things and free us. And the other thing that is there, this is a corporate action. So we think we're doing it on our own when we do it, but we do it with Arthur. We go into the gates of hell. When with Arthur, we go to the harrowing. And then we come to Cairo, so we do this with Arthur. So whoever Arthur is, this ancient god figure, ancient archetype, when we make this journey, somehow we are with Arthur. We're in the ship of Prudwen. It may feel like a solitary journey, but it is always a collective journey. It speaks of the potency of the internal experience, that actually, as we sit here, because we sit in this room, here together, we affect each other, and we affect all of the world, because we do this with Arthur, who is this figure working in the deeps of the world, working in the deep with the deep energies of the universe. He goes on to say, I am renowned in fame. The song is heard in the four square fort, in the island of the flaming door. Now, the mythologically, often in the Welsh tradition, Britain is seen as sometimes the island of the strong door, the island of the flaming door, that actually, as you, there is a door into, there was part of where this title of the work should come, there is a door into the hill that leads you into the mysterious, into the deep places of the earth. And sometimes called the strong door, sometimes called the flaming door. It's not easy. It's a strong door. It's difficult to open. It's a flaming door. You have to pass through fire, and it sounds very dramatic when I say that, of course. But actually, the passage of the door is what you did when you went inside. When you meet the resistances, they have aspects of the strong door, or the door of fire, or the place that wants to push us outwards and not let us go inwards. And in that place, there's a very bizarre image, but it's actually a medieval thing. Fresh water and jet are mixed. Now, this is a medieval, wrong bit of medieval understanding. Because what they thought happened when, I don't know how they came to understand this. If you make, one of the things they did in the, they had great natural history things, and they did lists of what would do if you put two things together. Now, if you put fresh water and jet together, it was supposed to ignite. It creates a fire. So they're wrong about that, but actually the image that the poet is using is as you go into this port, something ignites. You bring together something that is pure like water and clear, and you bring together something hard and dense like jet. So it didn't work as a chemical experiment, but actually as an alchemical experiment, actually it works very well, because you bring together bright, fresh water with something that is very dense, and then something ignites out of this energy of opposites. Because what happens when you go inside, you discover opposites, you discover this and that. And you know, the temptation always is, what's the right one? But actually, you because in a certain sense you are being the cauldron when you're there, when you're doing this, you let both things come together, and then notice the ignition, the shift that happens when opposites touch each other. And then it talks about another worldly feast. There is bright, if you do this, then you come into this feast. Bright wine is served to the host. Beautiful image, bright wine. Not dull wine or barred wine, bright wine. So there's joy here. It's a great feasting place, yes? And then again we get this refrain, three shepherds, etc. And then it immediately takes us to Kairigo. Now this is a famously difficult word. It can mean the cold or rigid castle, or it could mean the royal castle, and it could mean both. Because actually what's being asked of us here is to be either kingly or rigid, we could say, for the sake of this discussion. Because the king is at the center. The king can hold opposites. The king, in fact, has to hold opposites. The crown is not partisan, even in our society, right? The crown is above the opposites of political parties. So if you can be the center point, be the high prince of the kingly land, you let the opposites come together. The other thing that happens is we immediately go into rigidity. We go into the cold, rigid place of opposites, or fixed opposites. And we experience both. The poem is very realistic from that point of view, in its punning into play. As you go into these places, you experience the possibility of opposites fusing and igniting and bringing something new. We are fire. We also experience rigidity and coldness and stuckness. Both are there. And then he goes on then to pursue the point of rigidity, because he brings in the image of the Lord's bookmen, who I like to think of as tax inspectors. Apologies if any of you are tax inspectors, or you have anyone you love who are tax inspectors. I'm thinking of them as a generic class rather than as people. I'm sure there are lovely bardic tax inspectors out there, but they're not the ones I deal with. The Lord's bookmen are, in a way, it's a play from Kairigo, from the Castle of Coldness. It's those who cannot see out. Now, Widrir is a word that means castle of glass, but glass in their terms, in Medley, glass was this greenish blue substance that's really hard to look into. It's like looking into the deep places of the sea. So the Lord's bookmen are those who look on the surface and are concerned with the detail. They cannot look into the deep place and see the task of Arthur. See Arthur doing his work. And he emphasizes then the other thing that happens in this work is Caergolydd. Suddenly, having looked into the deep place, what you encounter is deep resistance. You come to the castle of the wall, Caergolydd. They also call the castle of digestion. It's a very interesting word, because it really says to there's a certain point in the descent into Anavin, no matter your skill, your ability, you find yourself totally blocked. You're given this image of a wall with 6,000 men and a sentinel who won't even talk to you, who will not parley with you. And in the stories, there's lots of stories about the hero coming to and parleying with a porter and riddling their way past. Here the sentinel won't even talk to you. And he's got 6,000 big boys to back him up. So you're not going to do it by force either. And so you have to be against the wall in the castle of digestion, being with the experience of frustration and difficulty, until something shifts from underneath. And as we come to the last sort of lines of the poem, again, he then kind of indicates what is the thing that's underneath the wall, what's there. Because again, we're given this image of, I give no reward to the clerics with trailing shields. Now, a trailing shield is a defeated warrior. Cleric, of course, is another version of the Book of the Bookmen. There's people who cannot really trust the deeper places, and sort of, so they are, he gives us an image of defeated figures who don't know, who think they know but don't know. They don't know who created who, nor the hour when the chick was born. So we're suddenly right in the beginnings of things again. Who made the chick? And this is another version of Mabon, the chick. It's koi is the word. God knows what koi means. She's translated it as chick. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what the word koi means. But the impression of most of us who studied it is that it is again relating to this kind of the son of light figure who is arising out of the deep place of Anuvin. Who made him, why he went not to the meadows of Dovwees. So there's the place of knowing the creation of this liberating being, this liberating energy inside ourselves. And who has places that he should go and places he should not go. And in the understanding of that energy, you know where to take it and where not to take it. They know not whose is the brindled ox. Now the ox is this great image that turns the stars. The great image they often had of this, the wheel of the stars being turned by this great ox figure, who therefore generates everything. But an ox is a castrated bull. He's brindled, it's black and white, so we've got this bizarre image, very strange image, of the universe being turned by this kind of figure who generates everything and yet is castrated. Not easy to be with these things. And again, we come back to, still with Arthur, on an arduous visit. It's feeling very arduous at this point as we get to this. And then we come back again. He's attacking the clerics. I give no reward to the clerics of weak intent. Now, intent and will is crucial in this work. Because as we hold our intention, if we're going to go into the mystery, the formless place that is Anuvin, the very deep place, we have to hold our intention to be present, to not split the world, to trust the deep process. So our intent needs to be quite strong if we're going looking for the sword and the cauldron and the place of the wall. You have to, your will has to be consistent, contained. Who do not know on what day the chief is made. Now that word chief is pen again. So this is this word pen, which we find in the first branch of Poich, who is the head of David, pen, also Poich pen Anuvin, head of Anuvin, is the, in a way, this is the place that the bards are aiming to create, to become a pen Anuvin, to have reached the origin of the otherworld experience, and to be the person who can work with the cauldron and work with the sword, who can free the prisoner and who can bind, who can work with the opposites of freeing and binding, who can work with the opposites of the sword and the cauldron. And the silver-headed beast that is guarded is the white stag that is found at the beginning of the Mabinogion. It is the stag that leads people. So the Pen Anuvin who guards the stag, part of their duty is to enable others to move into Anuvin by following the white-headed beast, which can be stag or can be Pen Anuvin, who can be hound of Anuvin, who can be a white boar sometimes. So this silver white mysterious beast that leads you into the other. When we went with Arthur, disastrous contention. So this, it's also saying that this is a stirring up sort of thing. It is contentious. It changes the world. And it then takes us to Cairochren, which another word, famously difficult word, sometimes translated as the castle of the trees, sometimes related to the castle of edges, sometimes called the castle of the keys. And there's something in that whole constellation of here you're arriving at the place that is like the trees or has the keys of life, or is the places where actually finally you go over the edge. And that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you do it. And then finally, he has another, he loves having a prop at monks. He says, "Monks howl like a choir of dogs from a contest with men who know." The men who know, of course, here are the bards. They are those who have followed the path that Taliesin is laying out. Because what they know is that they know that the wind has one track, the sea is one water, fire is one fierce, invincible spark. That's beautiful poetic images, but what he's saying, speaking therefore, is the complete interconnectedness of everything. That the wind has one, that all the wind has one track. That all the seas are one water, and all fire is one fierce, invincible spark. It's an extraordinary vision of an interconnected world. And then we end finally with the monks crowding together like wolves now, because actually the shift of image, dogs are less dangerous than a bunch of wolves. Now the monks are stirred up and are like wolves that could bring you down. So they crowd together like wolves from a contest with men who know. Again, he points out what they don't know and therefore what the bards do know. They don't know the divisions of midnight and dawn. They don't know where the wind blows or where it strikes, where it is ravaged, what land it strikes. They don't. It's really, you know, very challenging the monks or the clerics and saying, "You're not in touch, guys. You're not noticing. You're not present. You're not aware because you're in the place of dogma, of faith, of." Cognitive, you know, medieval scholastics, which is the place people are being attacked here. We can't really get to their mindset anymore, really, because this very, very detailed thing where they think they know everything. There's no space for anything. Which he's absolutely overturning that. But then the next thing he does is strange. The saint's grave lies hidden deep in the ground. I praise the sovereign, the great high prince. May sadness leave me. Christ is my protector. So having dissed the monks, dissed the clerics, suddenly he brings us to Christ. Hallelujah, brothers and sisters. Okay, but what he brings us to is, in a sense, I suppose we could say the Gnostic Christ, or the Christ that is like the Mabon, like the Son of Light. And he gives us, right at the end, this further mystery of the saint's grave hidden deep in the ground. What's that saint? Could be Merlin. Could be Rhiannon.
Inspiration.
It could be many things. That's the thing. And the other thing that he does is he praises the great high prince. He swings us around to the beginning of the poem again. Because what he's doing is stretching language as far as it can go by swinging us back and forth, back to ourselves, back to the place again where you encompass the land. And that, in a way, that's literally what happens as you make these journeys, as we come out again, you know, we come to another turn of the spiral. Again, we're invited to come in and then now listen to the song, the song of the prisoner, that is resonant with the tale of Porcupinemi. I think we're ready for lunch. So we'll come and we'll talk.